Have you ever felt the frustration of using an incredibly smart AI assistant, only to realize it is completely blind to the actual data, articles, and notes you care about?
Oh, yeah, it happens all the time.
Right. It's like having a genius research assistant who isn't allowed to look at your desk.
Exactly. They have all the reasoning power in the world, but zero context about your actual life or, the projects you're working on.
Yeah, and it's a very modern kind of friction. The
Right.
machine has this incredible capability to synthesize and analyze, but the interface between your personal data and the model's brain is just, well, it's a solid brick wall.
The total roadblock.
So if you've ever felt that wall, you're going to love the source material we are diving into today.
It's a really fascinating one.
It is. It's an engineering log from April 20, 2026, titled AX Radar Needed a Second Face, One for Agents.
Basically, a developer got so fed up with this exact blind AI problem on their personal news curation app, the AX Radar, that they decided to do something about it.
Yeah, they built it a second face, one designed entirely for non-human consumers.
Which is such a wild concept when you think about traditional software design.
It really is. So our mission for this deep dive is to unpack the surprisingly elegant system design choices that made this happen. We'll explore why high-tech security doesn't always mean using the heaviest encryption and the secret manual that keeps an AI agent from acting like a kid with a wrench.
I love that analogy. This log is really a look under the hood of how software is evolving right now.
Shifting from building just for human eyes to building for autonomous agents.
Right. And the architectural decisions you have to make to do that effectively are, they're just very different.
So before we get into the mechanics of that shift, let's look at the roadblock this developer actually hit. Part one of their project was building what they call the first face.
The web dashboard.
Exactly. It's news.ax0x.ai, designed entirely for human eyes. The developer would sit down, scan their daily feeds, read the items, and just save the ones worth returning to.
It's a completely visually driven application. You load the page, you scroll through the curated feed, you click on what interests you. The human brain is doing all the heavy lifting there.
Right, the filtering, the connecting of ideas. But then, and here's where the problem starts, they tried to bring AI into the loop.
Naturally.
Yeah. The developer turned to their local AI assistant, Claude Code, and basically asked, "Hey, what's on the radar worth reading today?"
And the AI just shrugged.
It literally just shrugged and asked for a screenshot of the dashboard. It was totally locked out. It had absolutely no access to the 15 curated items the human had just saved.
Or any of the editorial commentary attached to them,
So
right?
exactly. Think of it like owning an incredibly exclusive VIP club. That's your back-end data. You built this beautiful grand front door for humans to walk through. But suddenly you realize the robots, who you actually want to be your personal shoppers inside the club, are just stuck outside on the street.
Just peering through the window.
Yeah. Asking you to describe the party to them through the glass.
The intelligence exists, but there's no semantic bridge between the AI and the database.
So the solution shipped in this log was to build that bridge, and they did it at serious scale. This wasn't just a tiny weekend hack.
No, not at all. They shipped an HTTP API, an MCP server, which is the Model Context Protocol, and a Claude Code skill.
We are talking about what, like 1600 lines of code?
Yeah, around that. Touching 20 files and running 14 integration tests against a real Postgres database.
That's the crazy part to me. No mock data.
Right, real database calls covering over 6,800 enriched items and handling 68,000 LLM calls.
Okay, looking at those shipping stats, something definitely stands out. They touched 20 files, but they clearly didn't build a completely separate backend for the AI.
No, and that's a crucial architectural decision. They forced both the human web interface and the new agent API to share the exact same underlying SQL query layer.
Single source of truth.
Exactly. It's a fundamental principle of good system design. Single source of truth, multiple modes of access. If you build separate backends, one for humans, one for agents, you inevitably end up with state mismatch.
Like, the web interface gets updated to version 3, but the API is forgotten and stays on version 2.
Yes. By sharing the underlying query layer, if you change the scoring policy or add a new data field, both the human face and the agent face see it instantly, no lag.
Okay, let's unpack this next part because it's super interesting. They decided to build doors for the AI directly into the core logic, but they actually built two completely different types of doors.
the HTTP API, and the MCP server.
Right. Now, I know MCP stands for Model Context Protocol, and it's designed specifically for AI agents to auto-discover tools.
Yes, it's the new standard for that.
So if MCP is this incredibly fast, modern protocol built exactly for this purpose, why even bother building and maintaining the older HTTP API? Doesn't that just create unnecessary work?
It sounds redundant, I know, but it really comes down to the philosophy of integration costs. The HTTP API is the fallback.
The fallback.
Yeah, because it relies on REST representational state transfer, which is essentially the universal language of the web.
Okay, right.
It's a standardized way for any two systems to talk to each other over the internet using basic commands. .t, post, that kind of thing.
So any runtime environment that speaks REST can hit that HTTP API.
Exactly. That means older tools, standard automation platforms like AnyDayN, LangChain, or OpenAI function calling, they can all access the data. It's the long tail guarantee so that nobody is locked out.
Ah, so it's like making sure your building still has a standard keyhole, even if you install a fancy biometric scanner.
That's a great way to think about it. Now, the MCP server, on the other hand, is the fast lane.
For the modern AI ecosystem.
Right. For local tools that support it, like Claude Desktop or the Cursor Code Editor, the integration is almost magic. You don't have to install bulky software development kits.
And zero glue code.
Right. Zero glue code. You literally paste one single JSON block into a local configuration file.
But how does pasting a block of text into a file actually connect a local AI to a remote database? What is the actual mechanism there?
So think of that JSON file as a digital handshake. When Claude Desktop boots up, it reads that configuration file. The JSON block basically tells Claude, hey, there is an external server at this specific web address, and it speaks the model context protocol.
Okay, I'm following.
So Claude reaches out to that address, and the server replies with a list of tools it can perform, like searching the newsfeed or retrieving an article. And then Claude automatically absorbs those tools into its own capabilities.
It just works.
It just works. But if you only shipped that MCP fast lane, those users on platforms like NAN are totally stranded.
And if you only ship the HTTP fallback, the Claude users have to manually write all the function wrappers themselves.
Exactly. By building both, they cover all their bases. And because both of these doors are just thin adapter shims over that exact same shared business logic, the maintenance burden is tiny.
Thin shims give you maximum reach.
Two thin shims beat one massive monolithic integration any day.
Okay, but maximizing reach and opening brand new doors into your core logic introduces a massive problem for anyone building software. You've just given attackers two new targets.
Oh, absolutely. Security becomes a huge deal.
Right. If you are letting automated agents ping your database constantly, how do you check their IDs at the door without creating a massive bottleneck?
This is where we get into some really elegant engineering decisions regarding authentication. The system uses bearer tokens.
Okay. What does that look like in practice?
Each token is a string of 32 random bytes, which gives you 256 bits of entropy. And the database only ever stores a SHA-256 hash of that token, never the plaintext itself.
Now, if you're a developer listening to this, your first instinct when securely storing anything that resembles a password is probably to reach for a bcrypt.
Yep, the industry reflex.
It is the gold standard for password hashing.
Yeah.
But the developer in this log actively argues against that reflex. They claim gcrypt is completely wrong for this specific use case.
What's fascinating here is how they break down why it's wrong. We have to unpack what bcrypt is actually designed to do.
Okay, let's do it.
Bcrypt is intentionally designed to be slow. It uses techniques like key stretching and repeated hashing rounds to be computationally expensive.
Why would you want it to be slow, then?
Because human passwords are terrible. They have very low entropy, meaning they are super predictable.
Ah, like password 123.
Exactly. If an attacker steals a database of password hashes and those passwords are password 123, they can just guess millions of combinations a second until they find a match.
So bcrypt forces the computer to work so hard on each guess that offline brute force attacks become practically impossible.
Right. But an API token isn't a human typing password 123. It's a machine generating 32 purely random bytes.
Which carries 256 bits of true mathematical entropy.
Yes. To put that scale in perspective, you could have every computer on Earth guessing nonstop, and you still couldn't brute force a single 256-bit token before the heat death of the universe.
Wow.
The math itself is the barrier. You don't need artificial slowness.
So putting bcrypt on a 256-bit token is like installing a foot-thick titanium vault door on a spaceship that is already falling into a black hole.
That is exactly what it's like.
It's entirely the wrong type of protection for the environment, and the sheer weight of it is just going to drag your ship down.
And the weight in this scenario is literal database performance. When an agent requests data, the system needs to verify its token instantly. By using a SHA-256 hash with a unique index, looking up that token takes one B-tree hop in the database.
Let's demystify that for a second. What is a B-tree hop?
Think of it like looking up a word in a perfectly alphabetized dictionary. You don't read every single page. You open it to the middle, see if your word is earlier or later, and have the search space.
Oh, I see.
A B-tree index does that mathematically. It takes milliseconds and scales beautifully, even with millions of records.
And if they had used Bcrypt instead?
The database can't use that elegant dictionary lookup. Bcrypt incorporates random data called a salt into every single hash. Meaning to find a match, the database has to read every single row in the table, extract the salt, run the computationally expensive Bcrypt algorithm, and see if it matches the token. It's a full table scan.
Oh, wow. So if you get a sudden spike in traffic, like a high volume of queries per second from an overly enthusiastic AI agent, your database server would literally melt under the load of trying to calculate all those hashes simultaneously.
The CPU utilization would hit 100% almost instantly. It really highlights the danger of blindly following best practices.
Because Bcrypt is a best practice for human passwords, but applying it to high-entropy machine tokens introduces a massive performance bottleneck for zero additional security.
Right. System design requires critical thinking about the specific mechanics of the problem, not just copying and pasting solutions.
Okay, so the AI is through the door. It's securely authenticated in, what, 5 milliseconds without melting the database?
Yep, lightning.
Now it has to actually read the radar, and this requires semantic search, searching by the meaning of a phrase rather than just matching exact keywords.
Which is usually a massive headache.
Yeah, when I hear semantic search, my brain immediately goes to spinning up external vector databases like Pinecone, managing massive API integrations, tuning HNSW parameters, and just burning cash on cloud services.
It's notoriously complex to set up from scratch.
But looking at the stats in this log, they pull off semantic search for 0.002 cents per query. That shouldn't be possible.
Well, the developer actually braced for that exact nightmare scenario of building complex new infrastructure, but then they realized the rails were already laid. In an earlier release, I think it was the M2 release, they had already set up a HFAC column in their Postgres database paired with an HNSW index.
Okay, we need to break both of those terms down. Let's start with a HFAC column. Is that literally just half of a vector?
Basically, yes. In terms of computer memory, a vector in the context of AI is just a way of mapping the meaning of text as coordinates on a multidimensional graph.
So words with similar meanings are plotted closer together.
Exactly. This database was storing 3072 dimensional vectors generated by OpenAI's Text Embedding 3 large model. A HFAC column just uses half-precision floating-point numbers to store those coordinates. It drastically reduces the storage space and memory required without losing the semantic meaning.
Okay, what about the HNSW index? How does that help the AI find those coordinates?
HNSW stands for Hierarchical Navigable Small World.
Which sounds incredibly intimidating.
It does, but imagine trying to find a specific indie coffee shop in Tokyo. You don't walk street by street from the airport. You take a high-speed train to the general district, then a local subway to the specific neighborhood, and then you walk the last few blocks.
That makes sense.
HNSW builds a similar navigation map for data. It creates layers of connections between these vectors, allowing the search algorithm to leap across the graph to the general vicinity of the meaning and then zoom in on the closest matches.
But wait, why do they already have this complex 3072-dimensional map of their data built if they hadn't even started working on semantic search yet?
Ugh. Its original purpose was just cross-source deduplication.
Deduplication.
Yeah. If 5 different news outlets published a story about the exact same event, the system used those vectors to group them together into one row so the human user wasn't spammed with duplicate articles on their dashboard.
Oh, so the heavy lifting of turning text into meaning was already happening silently in the background.
Exactly. Repurposing that existing structure for semantic search was almost trivial. It took just 24 lines of SQL code and one single call to the AI embedding model.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Was this just an incredibly lucky break for the developer, or is there a bigger system design lesson here about how we should build databases in the age of AI?
I think it's a huge lesson. If early infrastructure is designed generically rather than hyper-specifically, massive future features end up costing practically nothing.
Because the rails were already laid. Yeah. Search just rode them.
Right. They didn't build a rigid deduplication tool. They built generic vector storage. And the performance here is staggering. We are talking about 250 milliseconds end-to-end latency.
And most of that is just waiting for the embedding call, right?
Yeah, 150 milliseconds for the external call to OpenAI, and the local SQL search on that map takes only 80 milliseconds.
Amazing. Okay, so the AI has the Fastlane MCP pipe. It checks its ID in 5 milliseconds, and it searches the database using existing vector coordinates.
It's all hooked up.
It can find the data. But having the search results isn't enough.
Yeah.
How does the AI actually understand what it's looking at? The log mentions that if Claude searches for a story and gets back a relevant score of 72, it has absolutely no idea what that means.
Right, or what the HKR axes are. This is a crucial gap in how we currently think about agents. MCP, the protocol connecting the AI to the database, only exports signatures.
Signatures, like the technical definition.
Yes. It tells the AI the tool's name, the parameters it accepts, and the shape of the data it will return. It does not export semantics. It doesn't explain the business logic.
So to the AI, a score of 72 could be an incredibly high priority, or it could mean the article is garbage. MCP doesn't translate.
No, it doesn't. The domain knowledge, the actual meaning of the data, and the human rules for how to interact with it has to live somewhere else entirely.
And where is that?
In the system, it lives in a Claude code skill. It's a literal markdown file named .skill.md that sits alongside the code.
Ah, so MCP is just the pipe. It hands the AI a wrench. But without the skill manual, the AI is like an eager kid with a wrench just whacking away at the wrong pipes.
That is the perfect visual.
The skill tells the AI how to be a plumber.
Exactly. It acts as the operational guardrails. The skill explicitly tells the AI when to use semantic search for the general gist of a topic versus lexical exact string search when looking for a specific name.
Okay, so it gives it strategies.
Yes, and it sets rules. It tells the AI, do not blast the raw news feed into the user's transcript. It even codifies editorial policy.
Like the rule mentioned in the log where YouTube sources never receive certain exclusion scores.
Right. It's basically injecting the human editor's brain and preferences into the AI before it even touches the data. Skills are arguably the most underappreciated layer in agent design right now.
Because everyone is focused on the plumbing.
Exactly. The industry is obsessed with the pipes and the protocols, the MCPs and the vector databases, but the skill is what bridges the gap between raw technical capability and actual human utility.
Because without that manual, you just have a powerful machine making naive decisions about your personal data.
Exactly.
So let's look at what happens when all these layers actually orchestrate together. When the back-end database, the Fastlane MCP pipe, the skill manual, and those generic search rails all fire at the exact same time.
It's a pretty seamless process.
Walk us through it. The developer breaks down the workflow of what happens when you type a simple human sentence. Brief me on this week's radar.
Right. So it triggers a beautifully orchestrated six-step process. Step one, the local skill loader scans your phrase, matches the intent, and loads that .skill.md domain context into the AI's working memory.
Okay, so now the AI has the manual.
Yes. Steps two and three. The skill manual instructs Claude to use a specific tool called Axerdar feed and tells it to pull exactly 30 featured items.
Got it. Step four is a security check, right?
Yep. The MCP server catches that request, verifies the SHA-256 token hash in 5 milliseconds via a B-tree hop, and queries the Postgres database using the semantic vectors.
And then steps five and six.
Claude takes those retrieved items, reads a pre-formatted markdown resource, specifically axradar.today, and structures the final briefing. It cites the specific articles and drops in the human editor's analysis seamlessly.
And this entire end-to-end magic trick takes just a few seconds.
It's incredibly fast.
But the developer is also really transparent about what isn't shipped yet, which I think is just as illuminating as what is.
Oh, for sure. They acknowledge some significant missing pieces. Like, there are no push webhooks yet.
Meaning the agent can't alert you?
Right. The agent can pull data when you explicitly ask it to, but it can't tap you on the shoulder proactively and say, hey, a new priority item just dropped on the radar.
Got it. And there's also no multi-user scoping yet. Right now, it's one token per instance. Everyone sharing the system shares the exact same .skill.md editorial policy.
Yes. And conceptually, the most ambitious missing piece is agent-to-agent pipelines.
Oh, this part was fascinating.
They envision a world where one autonomous agent is out there scraping the web to feed the radar database, and a completely separate agent consumes that radar via MCP to draft your morning digest.
But right now, only that second half exists. The ecosystem isn't fully closed.
Exactly. We're still early.
So what does this all mean? The developer points out at the very end of the log that this ship, despite all the technical complexity we just discussed, the hashes, the vectors, the protocols didn't actually build any new consumer features. They describe it simply as thin shims over thin shims. Why is that architectural shift so revolutionary?
Because it represents a fundamental shift in how we define product value. The value of an application isn't just in the human-facing features anymore. It's in the shape of the system.
The shape of the system.
Yeah. Product building used to be exclusively about adding buttons and visual flair to a web interface. But this engineering log argues that the back half of product building is actually about adding access modes.
Right, because if your data is truly valuable, it will eventually have non-human consumers. Agents, internal services, partner pipelines.
And those consumers do not care about your beautiful web UI. They want a fast, stable, semantic contract.
So we've explored how giving an AI direct, structured access to a backend transforms it from a blind, helpless assistant into a deeply integrated partner.
It really does change everything.
By using the speed of the model context protocol, the smart scaling of SHA-256 token hashing, and the explicit guardrails of a skill manual, the AI stops asking you to describe your messy desk and just starts organizing it for you.
It forces us to ask a profound question about the future of software development itself. We are rapidly moving toward a paradigm where the back-end logic is universal, and the visual interface is just one of many equal ways to interact with it.
Which brings us to a final thought for you to mull over as we wrap up this deep dive. The developer noted that the back half of product building is adding access modes for non-human consumers.
Right.
So as our AI agents get smarter, and as they start doing more of our reading, our curating, and our interacting for us across the web, we have to wonder, will there come a day when the first face, that human visual user interface we spend so much time designing, actually becomes the fallback?
That is a wild thought.
Will the graphical UI just become an occasional debugging tool for humans in a world where software primarily talks directly to our AI proxies?
It could happen sooner than we think.
Definitely something to think about the next time you're endlessly scrolling a dashboard, wishing your AI could just see what you see. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning how your digital world is built.